Thank you very much, Rabbi Gopin. By way of brief introduction, I want to say that this is most probably the most painful address that I have ever delivered. If somebody would have told me that someday I would come to Toronto to speak against a policy of the government of the State of Israel, I would have said, you're out of your mind, you're mad. If somebody would have told me that I would someday come to Toronto to speak against a peace plan of the government of Israel, I would have said, you're mad, you're out of your mind. But unfortunately, events are such that that's precisely what I'm here to do. And regardless of the fact that it's painful, it has to be done, it has to be said. I want you to know also that finally I understand the prayer that is said by a shliach tzibur, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur before Musaf, Hinini ha'oni mimas, I, unworthy, I am going to stand up now and be the representative of a Jewish people. I can feel the fear and trepidation that should grip a Baal Tefillah before Musaf on Yom Kippur. I feel that I am speaking on behalf of the majority of Jews in Eretz Yisrael. I speak on their behalf. I hope and pray that I will be worthy and will succeed in getting the message across. One other introduction, and it's unfortunate that I have to make this introduction. I am not opposed to peace. I say it is unfortunate that one has to make that kind of a statement, because those of us on the right have been viciously maligned as being opposed to peace. Chas v'shalom, a Jew opposed to peace? No such thing. We are opposed to this peace plan because we consider it a prescription for absolute disaster, God forbid. We pray for peace. We hope for peace. We long for peace. No Jew is ever opposed to peace. Yet this present Peres peace plan is nothing of the sort. It is not a peace plan. It smacks of Chamberlain's well-intentioned peace in our time. Kissinger's peace is just around the corner. So therefore I, and when I say I believe without any doubt that I represent the majority of Jews in Eretz Israel. More specifically, I am a member of a group that came into being some 2.5 months ago in Yerushalayim called the Ichud HaRabanim Leman Am Yisrael VeEretz Yisrael, the Union of Rabbis for the people of Israel and the land of Israel. A group of 1,000 rabbis gathered in the Renaissance Hotel in Yerushalayim and established basic principles for carrying on the struggle against this plan. And I came last week together with a number of Rashi Yeshiva and Rabbanim to the United States as the first of a series of groups that are going to come and speak to Jews all across the United States and Canada. In that group, we had Rav Nachum Rabinovich, who was Rav in Clanton Park, and Rosh Shiva of Yeshivat Ma'alei Adumim, Yeshivat Birkat Moshe, Rabbi Eliezer Waldman, Rosh Shiva of the Yeshiva in Kiryat Arba, Rav Chaim Drukman of Oretzion, Rav Yoshua Magnus of Merkaz HaRav, and we came with a Rebbetzin as well, Shifra Bless, whose husband is the Rav of Nevei Tzuf. She's a settler. So I say, that I represent the rabbinic voice of Eretz Yisrael. We believe that the document, the Declaration of Principles, the DOP, is ill-conceived, carelessly crafted, poorly drafted. It is a document of surrender to terrorism and a rejection of Zionism. There are many flaws in the agreement. The Declaration of Principles, by its very recognition of the PLO, creates a problem of catastrophic proportions. Implicit in the recognition of the PLO is the admission that there is a Palestinian diaspora. Why indeed did the government of Israel attempt to find Palestinians living in Eretz Yisrael to negotiate with for two reasons? Number one, because they were opposed, of course, to the PLO, which is a terrorist organization. But even more, by recognizing the PLO in Tunis, what the State of Israel is saying is, yes, there are Palestinians living throughout the world, and therefore implicit, or maybe explicit in that, is that now every Palestinian in the world has a right to return. This, of course, holds within it the seeds of the destruction of the State of Israel. Everything is open to negotiation. Anybody who reads the DOP sees everything is open. There will be negotiation about Jerusalem, about the settlements, about the return of refugees, security. Everything is open to negotiation. And if everything is open to negotiation, it means therefore that there will certainly be a great deal of give on one side, certainly a great deal of take on the other side that is certainly ready to take, but another side that is absolutely unwilling to give. We will deal with a number of these problems as we go on through this lecture. Another one of the serious problems that is not treated well in the Declaration of Principles is the question of hot pursuit. That's the hot term in Eretz Yisrael, hot pursuit. And what will happen if terrorists are going to come from the areas of the autonomy and they are going to perpetrate terrorist acts within Eretz Yisrael? Will Israeli soldiers be permitted to pursue them into the area of the autonomy or no? PLO says no. At first, Israeli soldiers would be permitted to go 100 meters, then it's 30 meters. Now it's something like about 6 meters. Can you imagine? The Ir Miklot for every terrorist, the state of refuge for every terrorist is going to be the area of the autonomy. Of course, we have been standing in the streets now for weeks with signs saying, Al titain lahem rovim, don't give them rifles, don't arm them. The idea of establishing a strong Palestinian police force numbering 20 to 25,000 is an act of sheer madness. And from what ranks are these police going to come? They are going to come from the ranks of those who are best trained to police their fellow Palestinians, the terrorists who are being released from Israeli jails. There's no doubt about it that written into that DOP is clearly the establishment of a Palestinian state. Something that every Israeli government has said, no, can't be. Another one of the problems built into the DOP is, and this former President Chaim Herzog wrote about a number of times, too fast. He said it was a terrible mistake to have put in dates, December 13th, April 13th, July 13th. Every stage of the autonomy should have been tested. And the next stage will come 6 or 7 months after stage one is completed, whenever that is. And if it takes years for stage one to be completed, so be it. But that everything has to be tested. We have to be certain that we can go from one step to the next. Of course, the greatest flaw in the agreement is that it was made with Yasser Arafat, who has broken 200 signed agreements with Arab states. By the way, those are all the agreements that he signed. He doesn't have a record of a single agreement that he has kept. That's with Arab states, with his brother Arabs. What hope could there conceivably be that he is going to be held to the letter of the law of this Declaration of Principles? Certainly we know at this point that two of the promises that he made he has not kept. The promise to renounce terrorism, the promise to amend the Palestinian covenant which calls for the destruction of the State of Israel has not been amended, and it's now 5 months into the process. And it doesn't seem as though anybody in Israel is going to make him keep his word. If he's not going to keep the first word he has given, what guarantees are that he's going to keep any others? And who is it that comes to the defense of Yasser Arafat? Prime Minister Rabin said he's not demanding of him to change the PLO charter because Yasser just doesn't have a majority of the Palestinian National Council who will vote with him. He may have 40% and no more, which of course is going to raise another problem that we're going to have to deal with. Who says that the PLO represents the Palestinian people? What may be taking place over here is one of the great crimes of history, that the State of Israel is imposing a dictator upon an unwilling people. Whoever gave the State of Israel the right to decide who is going to rule the people of Palestine? Furthermore, up until a few months ago, there was a national consensus. Up until a few months ago, there were a number of things that were clear across the board, right and left of Israel. All of those principles that were part of the national consensus have been broken in the past 5 months. There was the national consensus of no negotiation with the PLO. And incidentally, it still happens to be a law in Israel that one is prohibited from negotiating with the PLO. That law hasn't been changed either. There was a national consensus not to relinquish land on the Golan. The Golan Heights is a strategic area which cannot be left in the hands of Syria. That's a national consensus that this government has rejected outright. There was the national consensus, no Palestinian state. And during the first few weeks after the handshake on the White House lawn, there were still a number of members of the government who said, well, no Palestinian state. Rabin still is trying to avoid the establishment of a Palestinian state, which it's so clear and obvious to everybody that it is inevitable if this process continues. They swore on a stack of declaration of principles that there would be no removal nor abandonment of settlements. That was part of a national consensus. And again, in the first few weeks after the handshake, there were government ministers traveling around the country and saying, no. No settlements are going to be removed nor abandoned. It took a few weeks later that there were already voices that were saying, well, maybe some settlements will have to be under Palestinian sovereignty. That already told everybody that we better sit up and listen. Something is happening here that is in complete opposition to the national consensus. And of course, then there was Yossi Beilin 2 weeks ago who said that settlements on the Golan will have to remain under Syrian sovereignty. The absurdity, it may have been lost. It happened to be the day about 2 or 3 weeks ago that we were waiting for news about another few Jews that may be given permission to leave Syria by Assad. And on that same day, Yossi Beilin, our deputy foreign minister, says 10,000 Jews will have to remain under Syrian sovereignty. The absurdity, the absurdity. There was a national consensus that Jerusalem is to remain forever united under Israeli sovereignty. Any speaker coming from Israel or speaking to a group of Jews coming from Chutz Laaretz in Yerushalayim or any place in Israel, if he wanted to get the crowd to applaud, he always threw in a sentence somewhere in the middle, Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, will remain forever united under Israeli sovereignty, and the crowd would applaud. That statement has not been heard at least for 2 to 3 months from any member of government. Because shocking as it may be, Yerushalayim is also open to negotiation. The struggle for Yerushalayim is being played out on the Golan Heights and along the mountain ridges of Yehuda v'Shomron and in the Jordan Valley. Yerushalayim is up for grabs. The present accord is a rejection of the national consensus. In December, there was a Jerusalem Post story on a Friday, front page story, that the government plans to withdraw to the 67 lines and that Jerusalem is up for grabs. It was announced on Kol Yisrael at 8 o'clock in the morning and then again at 9 o'clock in the morning. By 10 o'clock in the morning, the newsroom editor had been suspended and it wasn't aired again. Since then, of course, the government has also canceled 1,100 subscriptions to the Jerusalem Post. Of course, the great mystery that to everybody is that the Israeli Defense Forces were completely unaware of the plan in advance, and there too, in the first few days following the announcement of the agreement in September, the Commander-in-Chief Ehud Barak and others said that it's impossible to implement. And then they fell silent, and I wonder why. Maybe even more serious than all of this is that this peace plan has caused such a division, a deep division, a rift within Klal Yisrael, unparalleled in modern history. We remember, history tells us 200 years ago, in Europe there was a machlekes between Hasidim and Misnagdim that tore apart Jewish communities all across Europe. It is all child's play in comparison to the deep, unfortunately abiding machlokes now in Klal Yisrael. I am frightened that it is a rift that will take decades to heal. If we want to understand the extent of the division, we most probably would have to study some of the periods of Bayit Rishon or Bayit Sheni. We're talking about a people that are torn asunder. I know that I can't speak to anybody who's in favor of the peace plan. I know families. I mean, it's all over. Families that if one is for and one is against, they don't talk to one another. They're talking about anger. A people that's angry. We feel that we've been put upon. We haven't been consulted. We haven't been asked. Our safety and our security is being negotiated away. The rift, of course, is beginning to reach the Israeli Defense Forces. I mean, once the question has been asked and it is now being debated very vehemently, should a soldier follow orders if he is told to evacuate settlers? Gedolei Yisrael have paskened under no circumstances. It's an immoral order. And soldiers have said, I didn't join the Israeli Defense Forces in order to forcibly remove settlers from their homes. It's going to weaken that on which our security rests. Tzahal. The Attorney General a few weeks ago, and I get the feeling, having been here now for about a week and a half, that there's a great deal that happens in Eretz Yisrael that simply doesn't get across over here. The Attorney General announced one day, he was only a few days in office, a new Attorney General. That's also a long story. I'm not going to go into why one Attorney General left and a new Attorney General came in. Attorney General said that Mo'etzet Yesha, the governing body of the settlements in Yehuda, Shomron, and Aza, that group is Guf Mamrid, a seditious and traitorous group. And therefore they should be removed from and held outside the law. There was an outcry in Eretz Yisrael. What are you talking about? Guf Mamrid. It took a few days later when the Attorney General had to say he was wrong. In any other democracy, an Attorney General who would have taken 150,000 people and placed them outside of the law would have no other recourse but to resign. But no, you can say whatever you want and keep going. The same Attorney General, when Rabbi Goren paskened that a soldier does not have to follow orders that are against his conscience, said he is investigating and he's going to put Rabbi Goren on trial. This was only about 5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago. Of course, Rabbi Goren, Erhard Meirif and Attorney Generals, Hartmischke Meirif and Attorney Generals. I believe it was Hanan Porath of Mavdal, who the next day, a day or two later, sent him the copy of an announcement that had been made a number of years earlier by Yossi Sarid and Yair Tzaban, both of them at present ministers in the cabinet, who had said that the soldiers should not serve in Yehuda v'Shomron. And that a soldier who doesn't serve in Yehuda v'Shomron, they're going to stand by him. He should refuse to follow orders. So here, of course, the Attorney General was caught in a terrible, terrible quandary. How is he going to prosecute Rabbi Goren when two ministers of the cabinet had said precisely the same thing? But today in Israel, if you're left, you're all right. If you're all right, you're left out. That's the way it works. The process that is taking place today in Eretz Yisrael is absolutely undemocratic. The government enjoys a technical majority of one. There are 120 members in Knesset. The government can muster 61 votes, a majority of one. Of the 61 votes that the government musters, 56 are Jews, 5 are members of the PLO, Arab members of the Knesset. Which means, of course, that what has taken place today in Eretz Israel is that in the Knesset, the PLO has voted to establish a PLO state. All questions can be asked at the end. You'll ask all the questions you want. And you will ask them at great personal risk. The government does not represent a Jewish majority. And there's ongoing confusion. There are many voices. We are being fed by rumor, not by fact. I spoke to my wife, Erev Shabbos, so she tells me that she received a fax somebody from Male Adumim that they had seen a secret report saying that Male Adumim is going to be an enclave within the autonomy. Can you imagine? Male Adumim. And here I come to what I believe may be the most important point I have to say. Since the signing of this agreement, the Prime Minister of the State of Israel hasn't had the decency to face the nation. Speak to the people. Tell them what your plans are. Don't we have a right to know? How far are you ready to go? Are there any red lines that you will not cross? Don't we in a democracy deserve at least that? A process that profoundly affects each and every one of us? The very security of the state? Don't you owe us a clear declaration of principles? Rabin and Peres have alienated large segments of the population. Rabin called the settlers crybabies. They're not real Israelis, quote. They are like Hamas, quote. Terribly, terribly ugly statement. Let them turn like propellers, quote, Rabin. The demonstrations, Zelome Zizli, doesn't move me. Peres, a few weeks ago, to an English-speaking demonstrator, said, why don't you go back where you came from? Government ministers seem to be able to speak, to smile, to socialize, and Rahman and Itzlan hold hands with every Abu around, an Abu Mazen, an Abu Musa, an Abu Dabu, an Abu Shmabi. They can talk to Palestinians all over the place. They can talk to them in Oslo, in Paris, in Cairo, in Geneva, in Taba, Davos, Switzerland. But they can't speak to the Chaim, the Avram, the Yitzhak and Yaakov of Tel Aviv, Haifa, Yerushalayim, Beit El, and Shiloh. In the United States of America or in Canada or in any country where a process of this sort would be undertaken, and by the way, there is no other country in history that has ever undertaken a process so dangerous to its own safety, the very least that one could expect is that the Prime Minister or the President would say, my fellow Israelis, this is what I plan to do. It's 5.5 months into the process, and nothing of the sort has happened. Furthermore, on July 4th, 1976, the State of Israel electrified the world. On July 4th, 1976, the State of Israel sent a message to an entire world. July 4th, 1976 was the day of the Entebbe rescue, and Israel then sent a message, we will fight terrorism every place and any place in the world. The long arm of the State of Israel is going to protect Jews wherever they may be. And a world stood up and applauded. And on September 13th, 1993, on the White House lawn, the State of Israel sent a second message. A message of unconditional surrender to terrorism. Just be a terrorist long enough, and we'll shake your hand on the White House lawn. I remember one day, listening to the news, we're always listening to the news. A report about one of the negotiations that was taking place at, then it was Taba, I believe. And they quoted the Israeli negotiator telling his Palestinian counterpart, quote, this government has not built a single settlement. I turned to my wife and I said, Bela, secular Zionism just died. It's all over. Can you imagine 100 years ago, a colonist in Rehovot or Petach Tikva or Gedera saying, we didn't buy another Jewish cow today. We didn't empty a JNF pushka to buy another dunam of land. What an obsequious, fawning remark to say, we're the good Jews, you know, you can talk to us. We didn't build a single settlement. These are the people that are negotiating away the safety and the security of the state of Israel. Secular Zionism, dead. It lasted 100 years. It lasted 100 years. The ball now is in the court of religious Jews in Eretz Israel. That's right, the kippot, shchorot, and srugot across the country. They are going to maintain the country. Secular Zionism no longer has the strength nor the will to continue the struggle for Eretz Israel. I want to say something now, and I want you to listen to me carefully. Five years ago, Meir Kahana offered Palestinians money so that they should leave Eretz Israel. He was called a bigot, a racist, a fascist, and he was removed by the Supreme Court of the State of Israel. He was removed from the democratic process in Eretz Israel because he offered money to Arabs to leave. And the present government of the State of Israel is planning to offer money for Jews to leave, and that's not racist. That's not fascist. Kahana was a fascist. But Rabin in Paris, to remove Jews, fine, that's a mitzvah. Can't remove Arabs. How absurd can we be? What's happened to Klal Yisrael? Arafat 2 weeks ago said, the Intifada will continue until the Palestinian flag flies over Jerusalem. Incidentally, he's been making these statements from the very outset of the process. There's never been any government response to any of the statements made by Arafat. Unfortunately, something has happened in the last 5 months in Eretz Israel that was never so. For 45 years, if you wanted to know the truth, you listened to the word of the State of Israel. Arabs, pack of liars. Believe me when I tell you today, if we want to know the truth, we listen to Arafat. He hasn't lied once since the beginning of this process. If we want to hear a pack of lies, the present government of the State of Israel has not been truthful to the people of Israel. They haven't told us the truth. They haven't told us anything. They have sent all sorts of confused messages. One day one minister will say the settlements will remain. The next day another one is going to say some settlements remain, others will have to be removed. There will be those that will be under Palestinian autonomy, others that will not be under Palestinian autonomy. It's a very, very difficult and bitter pill for us to swallow when we feel that we cannot trust the elected leaders of the State of Israel. This congregation adopted or entered into an agreement of twinning with Beit El. Let me tell you a story about Beit El. One of the victims of terror of the last few months was a young man by the name of Chaim Mizrahi, Hashem Yinkom Damo, a resident of Beit El Bet, that had crossed the road and went to buy eggs. He was the one who provided eggs for Beit El, and he bought it from a local Arab. been doing it for years. He was killed. It was on a Tuesday. Friday, I start getting calls. Rabbi, listen to the radio. The 1 o'clock news shook the country. There were five people who were involved in the murder of Chaim Mizrahi, and the announcement was that the five were members of the PLO. This shook the government to its core. Rabin had been saying for months, the PLO, since the handshake, there is no PLO terrorism anymore. By 2 o'clock, it became clear already that the government had known since Tuesday that it was the PLO that committed the murder. Yet Rabin had spoken to this to a number of settlers on Wednesday and told them, not PLO. Then the truth comes out on Friday. It's the PLO. By 3 o'clock, or right before Shabbos, the 4 o'clock news says, yes, it was the PLO, but the killers said that they had not been following orders from Tunis. I went to shul. I speak between Mincha, between Kabbalah, Shabbos, and Maariv on Friday night. I can get angry. I was very angry then. I was very angry and I was very depressed. I got up in shul and I said, listen, fellas, you all heard the news at 4 o'clock. Look what happened now. For 50 years, the excuse for killing Jews was we were only following orders. Now, it's a new era. Now you kill a Jew, and the excuse is we weren't following orders from Tunis. We weren't following orders from Tunis. Arafat is okay. No more terrorism. Then, the commander, central command, a few weeks ago on one day of the week, there was an announcement on the radio that groups of PLO terrorists had joined Hamas. That also was announced once, twice, and then it disappeared. Officer was suspended. He had no business telling the truth. PLO remains the PLO. So they'll go under another name. But terrorism remains. Arafat has not renounced terrorism. He hasn't given instructions that terrorism should end. He hasn't changed the Palestinian covenant. Once heard a very beautiful vort, I am a rabbi. And a vort is always good. Two vorts. In Parshat Chukat, it says the following. The Jews came into the land of the Amori, and there was Sichon, the king of Cheshbon. Listen to a few psukim in the Torah. Ki Cheshbon ir Sichon. Cheshbon was the city of Sichon. Melech Amori, he, king of the Amori. V'hu Nilcham, he waged war against Melech Moav Harishon. He waged war against the first king of Moab. Vayikach et kol artzo miyado, he took all of the land from him at Arnon, until the river Arnon. Al kenyonu hamoshlim, therefore the balladeers, those who sing the songs of war, say, Bo Cheshbon, come to Cheshbon. Tiboneviti konein ir Sichon. Let the city of Sichon be built and established. Ki eish yotzom mi Cheshbon, because a fire went out of Cheshbon. Lehova flame mi Kiryat Sichon, from the metropolis of Sichon. Ochlan it consumed, or Moab, the cities of Moab, Baalei Bomot Arnon. Listen, there were many, many wars in ancient times. There have been many, many wars in modern times. Why does Torah, which is eternal, why do we have to know about a battle that was waged between Sichon and the first king against the Moab, and that he captured Cheshbon. And the song, we even have to know the song of the balladeers, the songs that they sung after that battle. What's the importance of this battle? That it has to be known for all time. For all time. And the fact is that the Gemara says on this, Al Ken Yomru HaMoshlim, the rulers, those who rule over their evil inclination, Bo Cheshbon, let's make the great Cheshbon, the great calculation of the reward for a mitzvah in comparison to the loss by not performing a mitzvah. What one gains by doing an Avera and the loss incurred. So I once heard from my Rosh Shiva, Rav Rudam and Zecher Tzadik Livracha, said the following. There's a Medrash. Medrash says that when Sichon attacked Moab, so there was a little town, a little village, called Cheshbon on the border. Cheshbon was a flea-bitten town. It most probably had a general store and a bar. There was nothing terribly strategic about it. It was a nothing town. It was a nothing town. So the king of Moab and the commanders of Moab decided there's really no point in wasting time, men, material, equipment in order to defend Cheshbon. Let him have Cheshbon. So they, of course, made a strategic withdrawal. They removed whatever was in Cheshbon, and they just moved themselves 10 kilometers away. Waste time and lives over Cheshbon. Sichon took over this little town. Patience. He built it from a little flea-bitten village to a town, to a city, to a fortress. He brought in men, material, and equipment. He turned that little town not merely into a bridgehead, Festung Cheshbon. And from that Cheshbon, he destroyed utterly Moab. Al Ken Yomru HaMoslem, therefore, the balladeers say, Bo Cheshbon. Oh, you have to listen to the message of Cheshbon. Tibon eviti konein ir Sichon, the city of, because fire went out of Cheshbon and a flame from the metropolis of Sichon. Of course, that explains the Gemara. The Gemara says all that the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, wants, just a little beachhead, just a little aveihala, one little aveihala, and he's already made himself quite comfortable within the consciousness of the human being. And then he bides his time. You know, one Avera leads to another little Avera. And before you know it, the Yetzer Hara emerges victorious. But one dare never forget what the Medrash really is saying. There's no such thing as playing games with the safety and the security of the state of Israel. Oh, this is unimportant. This is insignificant. We can give them this and we can give them that. Torah makes it very clear. Bo Cheshbon. Make Cheshbon Shalom. You have to know precisely what steps you're taking. And then there's a Rashi. A Rashi at the end of Torah. Extremely important Rashi. Pasuk says, Barzel unechoshet min olecha. Barzel and Choshet, your locks are made out of metal and of copper. Says Rashi, Akshav u'medaber, now Moshe Rabbeinu is speaking to all of Israel. Shehoyu giboreihem yoshvim ba'orei asfar, their mighty ones, sat in the cities along the borders. V'noalim otah, they were the ones that locked the country before the enemy. Shelo yuchlu ha'ovim likanes, that the enemy should not be able to enter. Ki'ilu hisugura b'manolim, as though the country is locked with locks. The giborim, the mighty ones, are the ones who sit on the border. I will never forgive anyone. I will never forgive anyone who viciously and maliciously maligned 150,000 Jews of Yehuda, Shomron, and Aza. They are the Gibbonei Yisrael. They are Manu'ula Shel Eretz Yisrael. They are the lock. They are the ones who make certain that the enemy does not enter Eretz Israel. And we, in such perverse manner, were able to take these Jews and turn them into the obstacles to peace. Rashi has a second pshat. Davaracha, barzel unchoshet min olecha, artzichem ne'ula beharim. Your country is locked, shut off from the enemy by its mountain ranges. The mountain ranges of Yehuda v'Shomron are the protection of Eretz Israel. The people and the geography. And the government is ready to do away with both of them. I want to conclude just with the personal dimension of this struggle. I want you to understand that our lives have changed dramatically since September 13th. We went through a period of shock. There was a period of disbelief. It can't really be. Any day we're going to get up and we're going to find out that the whole thing just fell apart. That disbelief turned to bereavement and, in a sense, mourning. I remember one day, one of the women of my community called me up and said, "Rabbi, everybody knows that you're depressed. You're our leader. You can't be depressed." I listened to her. I said, "I am depressed." And then all of a sudden, my depression brightened me up. And I said to her, "You know, I understand it. It's great to be depressed." The Gemara says, "Kol hamit abel al Yerushalayim, whoever mourns for Yerushalayim, zochevero esimchata, will see the joy of Yerushalayim." I was mourning for Yerushalayim. On that Thursday that the Knesset voted to adopt the Declaration of Principles, so I'll tell you, in my apartment in Harnof, I tore pnia, I took off my shoes, and I sat down on the floor. We have gone through that process in Eretz Yisrael. We are now at the point of anger. And the anger is being channeled in all sorts of constructive ways. The message may not get across here, but on any given week, there can be tens of thousands of people out in the streets. The demonstrations, as Rabbi Goldman mentioned, across the Tzmatin, the intersections of all the main highways. There are days on which, sitting side by side and davening at the Kotel, it was a profound and deep emotional experience. And at least the press was honest. They said that this was a clear, resounding demonstration against the policies of the government. The fact is, the streets belong to the right. We own the streets. And we still maintain that it's a democratic society, and we're going to let our voice be heard. We are in crisis. There is no doubt about it. We are in grave crisis. The purpose of my mission, at least, is to give you a feeling, an insight into what's taking place. We eat, live, and sleep, as Rabbi Kopen said, the matzav, the situation. It consumes us from morning until night. We listen to the radio in the hope that something is going to happen that will slow down the process, derail it. Something has got to happen. Because what is taking place now is an act of supreme madness. So therefore, what you have done here, and what I believe that we began in Harnof, we had in early December, we had a ceremony of the twinning with the Yishuv Eli in the Shomron. It was on the fourth day of Hanukkah. Close to 1,000 people in shul. And following the ceremony in Shul, the second half of the ceremony took place in the Yishuv Eli. It's right next to Shiloh. It's named after Eli HaKohen. And right below Eli, Eli is perched on a mountainside. Right below it is the road that leads from Shechem to Hebron. It's called the Highway of the Patriarchs, Tzir HaAvot. You understand? The land of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. The land of David and Shlomo. The Aza of Shimshon, the Yericho of Yoshua. The Shiloh, the Beit El. I don't believe that a government with its poor majority of one in power for a year and a half will be able to dramatically change all of Jewish history. Can't be. It won't happen. All of this will now no longer be Jewish. Judenrein, we're going to remove Jews from their ancestral home. I can't believe that it's going to happen. I can't believe that Jews should want to do it. That Jews can live any place in the world, but not in Hebron and Beit El. Not in Shiloh and all of the other areas. So therefore, what do I ask of you? We ask of you, first of all, to be well informed. You have to be very, very well informed. I'm away from Eretz Yisrael for 2 weeks and I don't feel that I really know what's happening. You have to know what's happening. You have to find ways and means. And if it means that there will have to be more delegations of people coming here, listen very, very carefully. Mitzvah to be informed. Let nobody ever be caught in the position of grandchildren who will ask them, and Abba or Saba or Safta, and where were you when things were happening? Did you know? Were you aware? Did you speak out? Or it made no difference to you. We are at the most historic juncture in Jewish history. You have to be informed. Yes, you should enter into a relationship with communities in Yehuda, Shomron, and Aza. They are Gibore HaUma. They are the mighty. They are the mighty ones. I represent this group called Ichud HaRabanim. Yes. A group that has as its purpose to bring the message, the pain of Eretz Yisrael to Klal Yisrael, to assist wherever possible. It's not that we're working on a shoestring budget. We have no budget! And we are attempting to do battle with a government that has vast sums of money. Sums of money to the point that Yossi Beilin was able to say 3 weeks ago on Friday that we don't need your charity. We're a rich country. We're receiving donations from countries that are poorer than we are. Anybody who wants to help in this struggle, I ask you, help us. Yes, financially. We need the financial help to continue this struggle. I ask of you, do whatever you can. I ask if you also, don't we Jews believe in prayer as well? Tefillah? What I'm really asking you is to be tuned in not only to the news about Eretz Yisrael. You have to be tuned in to the feelings, to the emotions. They are deep. A struggle of great proportions is taking place. A struggle that's tearing apart the soul of Eretz Yisrael. Jews are being divided in a way they hadn't been divided in 45 years, or maybe in a thousand years. The situation is such, as I say, I don't know how long it will take to heal the pain of the last 5-6 months. I have absolutely no idea how we're going to get out of this situation. So there we have to look heavenward. I don't know how we're going to get. I've always told the members of my shul that one of the rules in the history of modern Jewry in general, and the state of Israel in particular, is the unexpected. The unexpected. You never know when the unexpected is going to happen. We pray for the unexpected Hatzalah to save Klal Yisrael from a situation. We got ourselves into this situation. I don't know how we're going to get out of it. Without God's help, I don't know how we're going to get out of it. So, I hope that in some small measure, I have represented the right of Eretz Yisrael. I have represented the feelings of the residents of Yehuda, Shomron, and Gaza. And it's not only Yehuda, Shomron, and Gaza. They are the front line. Eretz Yisrael is in grave danger. And the danger is not only the security, but also the spiritual dimension of Eretz Yisrael. There's a great struggle taking place. And no Jew has the right to feel that this is not his struggle. It's everyone's struggle. I hope and pray, somehow the Rabbeinu Shalom is going to bring a Yeshua salvation to Klal Yisrael speedily. Thank you.
I would like to bring questions.
I will entertain questions. I'll listen to questions. I'll try and answer questions. I scare them. Yes. All right. Dr. Silverberg? There are another 2 pages of notes that I didn't deal with. On this page of notes I have written at the top, trust me, I didn't write it now, the 2 questions. You're the second one. I write over here, what is your alternative? Right? That the question you're asking, Sammy? Yeah, in other words, what's my alternative? You're asking, what's my peace plan? All right. All right, but no, do me a favor. Ask the question there the way I want you to ask it. Huh? All right. I'm usually asked by people who are not so stubborn, I'm usually asked, what is your alternative? I'll deal with your question. So first of all, if a plan is bad, and it's a disaster, and it's a threat to Jewish lives, I have to fight it. That's not a viable alternative. It's not an alternative at all. What would have been my plan? I'm very happy that you asked it, because the truth is, rabbis are not supposed to get involved in politics, but today in Eretz Yisrael you have to be everything. You have to be a psychologist, you have to be a philosopher, you have to be a shtickl politician. Obviously the position taken by the right is the Camp David Accords, and what Shamir went to Madrid with, where the idea was personal autonomy, not geographic autonomy. The plan called, let the Arabs living in Eretz Yisrael lead their own lives. No one will interfere. We'll help them. We'll assist them. Govern yourselves. Run your own schools. Have your own hospitals, social welfare, whatever you want. Kenst leben in lachen. And more than that, you're going to leben lach better than any other Arab in any other Arab state. But not sovereignty over land. I'll tell you, in the snag in negotiations now, this is going to shake you. In the snag in negotiations now, all right, I'll say it. Arafat is right and Peres is wrong. What's the snag? You have to be a shtickl Talmud Chacham, you understand, to understand what's going on. The snag is, he wants to be in charge of border crossings, who comes in and who goes out. The moment you've given him sovereignty over the land, and it's his land, how can you be a balabas to decide who's going to come into his land or not come into his land? You're creating a state that that you call a sovereign state, but it's not sovereign. Arafat is right. If you give me land, then I'm a sovereign, and I'm the leader of a sovereign state. So magiali, I have the right to decide who will come and who will go. The Camp David Accords called for personal autonomy. The land belongs to us. It's all part of Eretz Yisrael. By the way, when Sadat came to Yerushalayim, you know what Sadat said in the Knesset? Every speck of sand in the Sinai has sanctity. It's all holy land. Do you know what Assad has been saying for the last 26 years? Every centimeter of the Golan Heights is holy land. No agreement unless we get every last centimeter back. The only ones who cannot make the statement that Eretz Yisrael is Atmas Kodesh, Eretz Yisrael is holy land, are Jews. What Sadat can say and what Assad can say, Rabin cannot say. Personal autonomy, not sovereignty over land. I know what the next question is going to be. The next question is going to be, now it's too late. You're right. That's why I don't know how it's going to end. The government has taken precipitous steps from which there is no turning back. Yitzchak can't call up Yasser and say, Yasser, we had a good idea, but we'll have to meet you again in another 100 years. That's why I don't know how it's going to end. I believe it was the handshake on the White House lawn was a criminal act. A criminal act that left no place for maneuver anymore. While nothing had been decided, nothing had been negotiated, forced Klal Yisrael into a position from which there. I don't know what the way of return is. I answered you. Go ahead. Good, huh? No. One per. Yes. Huh? No. Somebody behind you wanted. All right. Go ahead. You're confusing me. All right. Go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
Quick question. Can you comment on the voting pattern or lack of voting pattern? Oh,
the fellow over there was afraid to ask the question. Shas is an enigma. Shas is a tragedy. Shas, I would imagine, will be an accursed group of people forever and ever after. I don't understand Shas. Shas, let me tell you, is the Sfardi Haredi party that has six members of Knesset. While at present they are not in the government, at the time of the voting on the, they were originally part of the government. When it came to vote on the peace process, they abstained. They are someplace in a twilight zone, neither in the government nor out of the government. The government came into being only as a result of Shas. Without Shas, there would not have been a government. Nebuch, what can I do? People have taken steps. I mean, in Eretz Yisrael, we know the truth. They were paid $100 million for their first abstention. Can you imagine what they would have gotten if they would have voted for the peace flag? That was Mesiris Nefesh not to vote for it, to abstain. I can't explain. It's a mystery, and it's a profound tragedy that former Yidden can bring into power a government that has been more anti-Jewish and anti-religious than any other government since the establishment of the State of Israel. Former Yidden, Shem is a flesh that Aris. I don't understand. So if you ask me about their voting patterns, their voting patterns depend, of course, on the number of shekels involved. Good. Yes?
Just to follow up on what you said was an alternative to giving them sovereignty. Using what you said about Rashi, about the chain link fence, what we have to deal with, honestly, and I haven't heard anyone really deal with it, this chain link isn't on the border, but surrounds 1.5 million people who are black as the ages. and who possibly would never want your sovereignty. Now, you mentioned kind of that you paid the Arabs to leave. They weren't buying. So, what we really have to deal with, what I haven't heard with this plan about let them collect their own garbage, we don't even have people, despite the fact that you're doing better than any other Arab, don't want you, don't want your sovereignty, and either you have a Qahani response of forced expulsion or some biblical response of killing them, or deal with them realistically. But you don't even have Arabs who don't want you, who don't want your sovereignty. So the fence, I find, is a very interesting one, but it's one that surrounds the people who hate you, and not just being on the border. What do we do about it?
That was your, huh?
Shah.
All right. Okay, fine, fine. Who, that was Shah. All right. He's a member of Shas. I have a number of comments to make. First of all, we have to remember that in the, if we go back about 20 or 10, 15 years ago, we were being told by the prophets of doom that the demographic problem is going to overtake us. The Arab birth rate is very, I'm telling you, the Arab birth rate is up so high, the Jewish birth rate is down. Before you know it, there are going to be a majority of Arabs living in Eretz Israel, and it's all over. So while the prophets of doom were telling us this for about 15 years, the Jewish birth rate went up, the Arab birth rate went down, hundreds of thousands of Jews came out of Russia. Of course, if the government would have permitted settling not 150,000 people there, but there would have been 300,000-400,000 people there, the story would have changed more dramatically. If during the course of the past 45 years another 500,000 Jews would have come from the United States and Canada and settled in Eretz Israel, there would be no peace plan today, because all of Eretz Israel would be settled by Jews. So you ask, you tell me, but wait, there are in fact 1.5 million Jews, that a 1.5 million Arabs that don't want my sovereignty. True. So what you're really telling me is, from my point of view, is the problem is insoluble. Because if the only solution you can come up with is that which is going to endanger the very safety of Eretz Israel, that's not a solution. And therefore, if I'm going to have to plod along without a solution, it's better than the destruction of the state of Israel. Unfortunately, we live in a day and age that everybody thinks every problem has a solution. You have a problem, there's a solution. Not every problem has a solution. And this is one of the intractable problems that doesn't have a solution. It's as intractable as the Catholics and the Protestants in Ireland, and what's happening in Bosnia and Herzegovina, Serbs, Croats. There are problems that are maybe insoluble. We can offer them everything until it reaches the point where we endanger ourselves. There, the mitzvah of a Jew is following the Holocaust. I will do everything possible to ensure the safety of Jews. I'll never play with their security. So if unfortunately you don't want my sovereignty, sorry. I can't offer you. You don't want my autonomy? I can't offer you anything better. Anything better is going to endanger me. I don't have to die. And if two people cannot live side by side, I'm sorry, so it'll be an insoluble problem. What solution do you have? This, the present solution, this is a solution. A prescription for disaster. So it's insoluble. So it'll just have to be one of those problems where it'll be insoluble and most people will continue to live lebbing and laughing. And that's all. And yes, and the Arabs will have it a great deal better as they have it now than in any other one of their countries. Better than, do we have the right? As I said earlier, do we have the right to impose a dictator upon them? We've taken a Hitler and we've told you people, you know, he's your leader. Who says he's their leader? All of the elections that have taken place in the West Bank and Gaza in the last few months show that Hamas rules the rules Yehuda Vishomron and Gaza. Who gave us the right to do that? Oh, this solution is not a solution. Yes. You know, if you want the pros, find yourself a pro. If you want the truth, I think any human being that is capable of telling you dispassionately both sides is telling you neither one of the two sides. You have to hear, I'm sorry. From me, you heard one side. And I said it's one side. I said it's the majority of Jews in Eretz Yisrael. If this therefore has raised questions in your mind, I think it's a big mitzvah. It's good. Now go look for somebody to give you the other answers. I'm here to represent one side. Yes?
If there's any U.S. pressure on the whole
thing. I don't know. They say in Eretz Yisrael that there was no American pressure. And if there is American pressure, so for American pressure we're going to sell ourselves down the drain? I don't understand. I don't know. You know, when it comes to a question that I don't know, I just say I'm a rabbi, you know. I don't have to know politics behind the scenes. Yes?
We all hear that the majority of Americans are all feel the way that you're voicing your opinion. We know that the majority of Israel government is being held by a very narrow one or possible two seats, not including the Shas Party, which was discussed because they're being paid off to people. Now, how is it possible with hundreds of thousands of demonstrations that have gone on within the country of Israel that you can properly explain to me that they haven't been able to be mashpia, not on 61, okay, based it on one or two select people who might be borderline, that people haven't been able to be mashpia on? Why have the yeshivas not sent out thousands of talmidim to the homes of these people to sit and daven and cry day and night and beg them that they should see from their mysterious nefesh that they should change their opinion? Why is...
Can't answer it. All I can tell you is my wife stands out every morning from 9 o'clock till 10:30 in the morning in front of Rav Avadya Yosef's house, and she says till him for an hour and a half, together with a whole bunch of other women. And I can't answer that question. I can't. Incidentally, it is a mystery. One of the big mysteries in Eretz Yisrael is, up until this process, the Labor Party represented, there was the right of the Labor, the left of the Labor, and the center. And all of a sudden, since the peace process, everybody speaks in one voice. Nobody can understand that in Eretz Yisrael. There's no opposition within the party itself. I can't answer. Obviously, anybody who's going to buck the system is going to be summarily dismissed from the system. Not everybody has courage. We need courage. We need people with leadership qualities. We don't have leadership. Do you know where the leadership in this struggle is coming from? The man in the street. It's amazing. The number of voluntary groups all across the country. We were not ready for this struggle. We weren't prepared for it. It hit us like thunder. One day we wake up and we're faced with this problem. So wait a minute. First of all, give me some money, and then you'll see what I'll do. Boy, will we do. Huh? No, we're organizing ourselves. What do you think? But that's, I mean, it, we are in the process of organizing. We are creating an army to fight the government. The government's plan. We're creating it. We were taken by surprise. We were taken unawares. Didn't occur to us that this was going to happen. And I say the first month or two, we were hoping that the whole thing would fall apart. Then it didn't, so. Yes, whatever. Boy, you couldn't have asked a better question. You know, this is a comedy act. Me and Herb worked it out. It's a fascinating thing. Every time you talk, Peres is interviewed. Every time Peres is interviewed, and you ask him a place, Akasha, about Gaza, he starts talking to you about the great economic boom. The great Middle East. We're going to trade, and there's going to be money, and we're going to be Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and there's going to be planes and trains and buses going from Gaza to Damascus and from Chavez to Yerushalayim, who knows where. He's always talking about the economy. When Chaim Mizrahi crossed the road from Bet El Bet to buy eggs, the heartless comment of Rabin, I mean, it shocked the country. So he said, you'll learn not to go buy eggs cheap. Then I thought to myself, but wait a minute. This is part of the great economy. Jews and Arabs are going to trade with one another. That's all that Chaim Mizrahi was doing. And he'd been doing it for years. He was the one that provided eggs for Bethel. And he had bought it by his friend, an Arab neighbor. This is the great economic boom. I was fortunate enough last week in New York at a conference of the Rabbinical Council of America to hear a world-class economist, Professor Eliyahu Kanofsky. He is the world's expert on the economies of the Middle East. It's worthwhile getting him one of these days to Toronto to hear him. He's unbelievable. He was the expert to the American government. He was a professor in Columbia. He's now in Bar-Ilan. He has written a number of books on the economy of the Middle East. He said every word that Peres has said about the economy is nonsense of the highest order. It can't be. It will never be. And a number of reasons. First of all, he said that nearly every Arab country is bankrupt. Bankrupt. They have no credit anymore. There is no money there. It's all a facade. There is no money. Second, over the last 20 years, there have been 5, 6, 7 attempts at making an Arab common market. And every time they signed an agreement, they never wanted to do it because neither one of them wanted the other to maybe get an economic edge. Never worked. So they're going to enter into an economic agreements with Israel. And look, we have a 15-year peace with Egypt. 15-year peace with Egypt. Hardly a single agreement made with Egypt has been kept by Egypt. There's no tourism, there are no Egyptians that come, no culture, no economy, garnet with garnet. At least, thank God, no war. So that's also an accomplishment. But in terms of economic agreements, we're going to trade, we're going to heem, we're going to hair, this is completely a figment of Peres's very fertile imagination. Oh, I tell you, if I would be you, I would send a letter to Prime Minister Rabin. In Israel, they're not into letter writing. If a member of Knesset gets 20 letters on an issue, he knows that it represents 20,000 people. A member of Knesset told me that. If you write letters and say, "Yeah, we're extremely concerned about this plan," you are endangering the state of Israel. Well, I think it would be a great idea.
Where did the right-wing government
play? I don't know. I said before that we have very little leadership. I don't know. They have to get their act together. I don't know.
We'll take one last question. All right. All right, two. One, two. That's it. Go ahead.
How about Arafat, the person whom we trust so much? Can you remind the people that just over 3 years, he had to shake the hand of Saddam Hussein? This is the same man.
Yeah, I didn't think they had. People had to be reminded. Well, maybe one thing more, something that came to mind today when I saw that ugly picture in the paper. There's a fellow who wrote a book called The PLO Connection, and he visited the Ein Chilva camp in southern Lebanon some 10, 15 years ago. He was a journalist, and they let him in to visit the camp, and Yasser Arafat took them through the camp while they still had the training camps in Lebanon, before the Shlom HaGalil. And part of their training was there'd be a basket of chickens, and the upcoming soldier, you know, who most probably will be a member of the Palestinian Strong Police Force, had to be able to take a chicken out and just wring its neck off. So as he's walking with Yasser Arafat, and Arafat sees the fellow take the chicken out and wring his neck off, says, no, 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 that's not the way. And Arafat takes out a chicken and tears it apart limb from limb. He says, that's what we're going to do with every Israeli. And there, walk hand in hand with me, Shimon Peres with the hand that tore apart that chicken. That's who he was holding hands with in Switzerland yesterday. Go ahead. My opinion? I don't like to, everybody is becoming an armchair analyst, but maybe I will take a few minutes to say something, and with this we'll conclude. There was something that I alluded to in one word during the course of my remarks. I said that this was a struggle for the security of Eretz Yisrael, and I believe I also used the word the spirit or the soul of Eretz Yisrael. What did I mean by that? That's what somebody should have asked me. So I'm asking it myself. So I want to tell you something. There was an event that took place at the end of December, the very end of December. An event that at other times would have been an event of major, major proportions throughout the world. And it came and it went. Without, certainly in Eretz Yisrael, there was very little response to it. The Vatican signed an agreement with the State of Israel. Who was the one they signed with? Yossi Beilin. Why did the Vatican sign that agreement? Why did they all of a sudden decide to sign an agreement with the State of Israel? This is my own analysis. You may disagree with it, but I'd like you to think about it. What the Vatican saw was, first, in the agreement that was entered into between the State of Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization, no demand was made of the Palestine Liberation Organization to ask forgiveness and penance for all the Jews that were killed over the last 25 years. The past didn't count. Two, the State of Israel has not held Arafat to his commitment to change the Palestinian covenant. Number three, the Vatican saw that in this deal, Israel is giving away land. Therefore, for the first time, the Vatican saw, Balaam, this guy I can strike a deal with. He's not going to ask the Catholic Church to beg forgiveness for the millions upon millions of Jews that were killed because of Catholic theology. He's not going to ask the Catholic Church to change their prayers and
all of their other literature that denigrates the Jews and brought about a Holocaust? And if they've given away land, the Vatican wants a peace too. Yossi Beilin represents a kind of Jew for whom there is no past. There's no past. He is a completely secular, but more than a secular Jew. He is anti-religious. That's why the residents of Yesha, his worst enemies, most of them are religious. And I'll tell you one other thing that I understand with this. Why is he not interested in money, donations from diaspora Jewry? For one simple reason. Because if you're not a Jew of Torah, then you have no relationship with any other Jew on the face of this earth. He doesn't want any partners. He's an Israeli. He's not a Jew. That's the spiritual struggle that's taking place. These are the people we're up against. Ultimately, I'm certain we're going to be victorious. Thanks. Yeah. Say the majority of the demonstrators. The majority, 90% of the demonstrators are from. Okay. All right.
Thank you.